we're resuming Mark, but you know, as I was studying this text, the world really makes a lot of empty exhortations to believe, right? Believe. You go on the internet and you see this kind of trite. Believe all things are possible. Dream it, believe it, achieve it, right? Your sports team is losing. You got to believe. You want to climb a mountain. You got to believe. You know, you're facing relationship difficulties, financial crisis. Believe. But it's empty, isn't it? If the agent behind that belief is powerless to control the circumstances. And that yet the world wants to believe, but they don't want to specify who that agent is. And it's a total waste of time, total waste of effort if the agent is incapable of changing those circumstances. It's an empty faith, and it's inevitably going to result in cynicism. Because nothing in the universe except Jesus Christ, God alone, can change our circumstances. And so that's not true when it comes to Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as Mark has been introducing him. Only he's the only agent in whom you should believe, because he's the only one who can truly change your circumstances. The Apostle Paul said in Colossians 2, verses 9 to 10, "For in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form, and in him you've been made complete. And he's the head over all rule and authority." He alone can make you complete. He alone is the one that you need to believe in. And Mark has wanted us to know that as we've been studying it. Well, as we've been going through the Gospel of Mark, and which seems like 1,000 years ago, but we're resuming here. It's, you know, chapter, just to reestablish our trajectory in chapter 2, there's a series of conversations started with the Pharisees and the scribes, because Jesus is doing some pretty remarkable things and they're objecting. And so we see in chapter 2, we saw in chapter 2 mounting objections. You know, he heals sin and hangs out with sinners, and his apostles are reaping on the Sabbath, and they don't like it. And Jesus is in dialogue with them. Then we saw that Jesus heals on the Sabbath, which ends up being quite controversial. And then Jesus steps aside and he chooses the 12. But then we saw the rejection by the religious establishment. They've accused him of doing his works by Beelzebul. This is the official rejection of the kingdom by the religious establishment. The kingdom is off the table and deferred to a later point in time. So then Jesus shifts and starts teaching in parables to signal mostly to his disciples, look, sow the word and then let the Holy Spirit do the work, but the kingdom is not arriving during this time, my first time here on earth, is basically what's happening. So then, more recently, we've kind of moved into a section where Jesus is displaying sovereignty over hostile powers through miracles. And so this is the section in which we find ourselves. We saw in chapter 4 that Jesus stilled the sea, that he, in the last event that we looked at, some 7 or 8 weeks ago, he cured demon possession, the wild Gerasene man over in Decapolis. And today we're going to look at a couple more miracles. And so we're in a section of miracles that are speaking to the authority of Jesus over these hostile powers, healing incurable illness, and then raising the dead to life. And in each miracle, Mark is challenging us. This is why Mark is presenting these miracles. Of course, Jesus intentionally, but Mark is organizing the story of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And here's the question that we're to be challenged with. In circumstances that we're powerless to control and that threaten to destroy us, will we look at the circumstances and admit defeat? Fear will inevitably result. Or are you going to look to Jesus as the only one who alone can change your circumstances? If you settle for anything less than Jesus Christ, you have good reason to be afraid. The circumstances can destroy you. But will you put your faith and trust in Jesus Christ and believe in him alone? And so, will you believe by faith in Jesus Christ. And in the Gospel of Mark, Mark keeps putting Jesus, Jesus, Jesus forward. Will you believe by faith in Jesus? And that's what Mark is trying to hammer home here. And so will we believe that Jesus commands the elements, that he commands all the spiritual forces, including all of the demons, that he has the power to heal, and he even has the power to raise the dead to life? And will you believe that Jesus is able to handle your circumstances, regardless of the trial that you're going through right now? Do you truly believe? Do you really believe that Jesus can handle your circumstances? But the other thing about Jesus, and of course the Gospel of Mark, is there's always an element of unpredictability about Jesus' actions and his words. I mean, Jesus does the unexpected. He doesn't respect traditions. He directly confronts people. And then his words, he makes audacious claims that seem ridiculous to a lot of people. And so he doesn't leave us in a comfortable zone. Jesus always takes us out of our comfort zone. He surprises and does the unexpected, but God's ways are higher than our ways. And Jesus will not be put in a box. And that's why he's unpredictable. He wants you to be open to his revelation. You can't package Jesus and say, this is the Jesus that I want, and accept that. Because that's not the Jesus who presents himself. And if that's what you accept, you've accepted a Jesus who is not the true Jesus who has revealed himself. You have to take him at his full revelation. So when he shocks and surprises you, you have to step back and say, okay, Jesus, you're in control. You're God. You've got this. You know, when there's a disappointment, you've got it. I have to trust you. I'm just going to believe. And so Mark's strategy is to present us with a series of faith-building experiences after Jesus' audacious claims to basically be God and have power over all of these powers. So looking first beyond the power of the storm to see Jesus when he calms the storm. Looking beyond the power of evil spiritual forces to see Jesus. Looking beyond the power of disease and even death to see Jesus, that Jesus emerges above all of that. He's above all of that. And so he alone has the power to alter the inevitable courses of our lives. Will we believe that by faith? Because if you accept anything less than that, you have good reason to be afraid, because that agent is powerless to change your circumstances. Well, in the previous miracle that we looked at in chapter 5, the first 20 verses, we saw Jesus casting out a legion of demons and a wild man who's living among the tombs. And that whole story was just filled with uncleanness and defilement. It's hard for us to capture that or understand that today, not coming from the Jewish tradition within the Mosaic law. But this is just filled with uncleanness and defilement for the Jews at the time. And, of course, the setting for that story was over here in, so here's the Sea of Galilee. It's over here. This is a Gentile region. So talked about uncleanness. It's filled with Gentiles. And the whole thing takes place right there. And so the setting's on the eastern shore of the lake. This man has an unclean spirit. He dwells among the tombs where contact with the dead renders a person unclean. Of course, there were swine herders in the region raising unclean food for the detested, occupying unclean Romans. I mean, it was just filled with defilement. And so Jews of the time, they've just been bristling, right, with all that Jesus is doing. He's just like in the middle of this muck and mire of defilement. But Jesus cleanses, right? He cleanses this man. He heals this man. And then he makes an evangelist of that man. Well, that theme of uncleanness and defilement is going to continue in the miracles that we're going to look at today. All three characters in Mark chapter 5, this wild man, the Gerasenes, and today a Jewish woman excluded from social and religious life, and then the daughter of a religious leader who's going to die, all are defiled and unclean from a Jewish Mosaic law perspective. And yet, we're going to see that they don't defile Jesus. Jesus heals cleanses them. So we're also going to encounter another thing that we've seen in the past as we've been studying Mark. It's called a Markan sandwich and the healing of Jairus' daughter. And then in this, with this woman who's got a hemorrhage. And so, you know, I pointed this out a couple times. A Markan sandwich is where you have one story that starts. Think of it as parts A and B. One story starts part A. Then it gets interrupted. There's an interruption in the middle of the story. Completely different events. Then you come back to the first story to finish out the first story. They're all over the place in Mark. It's what's called a chiasm. And the reason that it's set up that way is these are unrelated events, seemingly. But the reason it's set up that way is that although they're unrelated, there's a theme. And the main point is found in the middle story. And the middle story tells us something, and they're related. It tells us a greater truth. So the truth of a Markan sandwich transcends either of the stories. And so how does that look in what we're looking at to do? So what I'm going to do is I'd like to give you a little preview of these. And for many of you, these are very common stories. You've read them a lot of times. You're very familiar with them. But I want to give a preview because then I think it'll attune us to, oh, here's what's going on in Mark. You know, here's what the subtle things, the nuances that Mark is trying to articulate here. So part A1, there's a desperate plea for a daughter with a life-threatening illness. Then the scene is going to shift to part B, where you've got a desperate woman with an incurable illness who's healed. And then it goes back to the first story, and the dead daughter is raised to life. So these are in some ways unrelated, except that Jesus is in the middle of them, and that there's a bigger picture here. And yet, even in spite of the fact that Jairus, and who knows if he ever had any contact with this unnamed woman with a hemorrhage or not in the town, we don't know. There's some common elements between them that are pointed out by one of the common commentators. Both are females healed by the touch of Jesus. Jesus calls both of them daughter, this 12-year-old girl and this elderly woman. The woman's illness and the girl's age are both given as 12 years. Jesus is met by rebuke in both stories, which we're going to see. And Jesus is brought into contact with uncleanness, and he's going to clean it up. So there's the common elements there. And so as we study it, we want to see it transcend. What's the transcendent story between Jairus' situation and this woman? Again, they maybe don't even know each other or relate to each other. But Jesus has a bigger point here in these events. And God has perfectly orchestrated these events to exhort people of his day and to exhort you and me today. So as a chiasm, the greater truth lies in part B. So if I could speak to that for a second. Part A1, we're going to see a desperate father imploring Jesus to touch his daughter. Would you lay hands on her? Then we're going to shift to part B. We've got a desperate woman who believes by faith and is healed by Jesus' touch. Then we're going to go back to Jairus' situation, and Jesus is going to exhort this desperate father to not be afraid and only believe in Jesus' healing touch. Will he? Will he only believe? Will you only believe in Jesus' healing touch? Because these aren't just dusty facts in a history book. God is presenting these narratives so that we respond in our hearts to what's going on. So, with that, let's start with part A1, and we're going back again. Jesus has left to this area of Gergesa, where the wild demon is, and he's going to the western shore. But we don't know where it is. It's not specified in the text. So in verse, so we come to part A1, in which there's a desperate father who implores Jesus to touch his daughter. So verse 21, chapter 5, and verse 21. When Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him, and so he stayed by the seashore. One of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up, and on seeing him, fell at his feet, and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live." And Jesus went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. So again, we don't know where Jesus disembarked. It's somewhere on the western shore there, but there's a very familiar scene. There are 15 references to Jesus' public ministry on the western shore of the lake. He's returning to where he's been ministering for a while. And of course, he finds a much more favorable reception on the western shore because we see a large crowd gathered around him rather than on the, over in Gergesa, where they got rid of him. They said, get out of here. They expelled him from the countryside. So Jesus is resuming his ministry in a Jewish region. And once again, and this is typical in Mark, a single individual steps out of the crowd. We always have the crowds in Mark. One individual steps out in the crowd and the focus is going to turn to that person. And that happens to be Jairus, one of the synagogue officials, meaning that he was the head of the local Jewish worship community. So this is a man of status and stature, and people recognize, you know, his piety as a Jew. Now, as the worship leader, he's not a professionally trained scribe or a rabbi. He's a lay member of the synagogue. It's a significant position, but he's responsible for the oversight of the synagogue and the orthodoxy of teaching. So he organizes the public worship, scripture reading. He's appointing individuals to preach in public prayer, but he's not a scribe or priest. But it's interesting that Mark tells us the name of this synagogue ruler. Mark oftentimes doesn't tell us the names of the people. Most of the time, we don't know people's names. But Mark chooses, for some reason, to tell us that this is Jairus. He stands out in Mark because he also proves that not all of the religious leaders have rejected Jesus. We saw the rejection from the, you know, official religious establishment, but that doesn't apply to all of them. Jairus, who we presume will come to faith, steps out as someone who shows some faith. He's coming to Jesus in faith here. So it means that not all of the religious leaders necessarily rejected him. And here's a member of yet another social class who is being given an invitation to the kingdom and seems, we would guess, to respond favorably, kind of like Nicodemus or Joseph of Arimathea. And it's possible, from what we know, it seems like the Apostle Peter is the one who gave Mark his content for the Gospel of Mark. And Peter is from Capernaum. So Peter maybe knew Jairus, especially if he's an individual of significant social standing. So that might be part of the reason why we actually have his name. Peter knows this man, perhaps. But it's interesting that a synagogue official would come to Jesus, because what's Jesus been doing? He's been wreaking havoc in all the synagogues. Everywhere he goes, he's doing stuff in the synagogues that he's not supposed to do. And, you know, the Pharisees and the scribes are railing against him. Here's a synagogue official coming to Jesus, this troublemaker, to look for him to heal. And there's nothing arrogant or superior about Jairus's approach. Indeed, we find him desperate but humbly pleading with Jesus because his daughter's condition is critical. His only daughter, I might add. And Jesus implored him earnestly, the verb meaning begged much, saying in verse 23, my little daughter is at the point of death. She's at death's door. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live. So note his belief that Jesus can heal his daughter. So Jairus has come in faith, but his faith is going to be seriously challenged, first by an interruption to his plans, and then by seemingly impossible circumstances. His daughter's actually going to die. So God is orchestrating these events to present serious, multiple challenges to Jairus' faith. Whatever little faith he brings, God is going to test him on that. And so at this point, it seems Jairus believes to some degree that Jesus can heal his daughter. But what is the limit of that belief? And how is God going to deal with that in his life? And so God has perfectly orchestrated the events to lay challenges to his belief. Will he truly believe? And Jesus does this repeatedly in the Gospel of Mark. He challenges the people there. He challenges us. Will you believe? Will you believe? Will you believe? And so both his desperation and belief in Jesus' power are going to have to grow before God is going to respond to his plight. And so he sees Jesus as his only option now, indicating, again, some measure of belief, but maybe he just sees Jesus as better or the only remaining option. Jesus is going to challenge him. And note also that Jairus asked Jesus to lay his hands on her. And this, again, we see as an element of Jesus' humanity that is all through the Gospel of Mark. Jesus' healing touch is throughout Mark. We saw it in chapter 1 and verse 31 with Peter's mother-in-law. He touched her and immediately she was well. We saw it in chapter 1 and verse 41 with a leper. Jesus touched this unclean leper. And he was healed. And then in chapter 3, verse 10, it tells us that all those with afflictions were pressing him in order to touch him. Jesus is fully God, but he's fully man. And he's in and he's touching people. And he's involved in their lives. He's in the middle of all of this. And we see Jairus calling for his healing touch. And so he's calling on Jesus to show the tenderness and compassion that has come to characterize Jesus' ministry. Why would Jairus ask this unless that's the way Jesus is operating? He touches people. He touches them, you know, physically, and he touches their lives. He cares about people. And so that theme of touching is going to continue through the rest of the passage. And then once again, in verse 24, Jesus is willing to be interrupted in whatever he's doing to respond to Jairus' desperate plea. And once again, we see the pressing throng following Jesus. Wherever Jesus goes, the masses are going to, you know, they're following along with him. But the crowds in the Gospel of Mark are always a backdrop to individuals who emerge whose lives are touched. And Mark's point is to bring those individuals into relief. The crowds are amazed. They want what Jesus has to offer, except his salvation. They want food or healing. But they don't believe in Jesus. Those very crowds are the ones who are going to be rejecting him, putting him on the cross. So that, again, there's an individual who emerges here. And so the crowds always add vividness to the circumstances of the individual who emerges from the story. Well, with that, Mark's going to introduce another character as we move to part B of the Mark and Sandwich. This is a desperate woman who believes by faith and is healed by Jesus' touch. Verse 25, a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of the physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse. After hearing about Jesus, she came up in the crowd behind him and touched his cloak. For she thought, if I just touch his garments, I will get well. Immediately the flow of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. See, here we have a quieter but an equally desperate soul emerging from the crowd again. One person stepping out. We have an interruption to the previous story moving over. And as Jesus is going to Jairus' house, and she wants one thing, to touch his garments, verse 28, believing that she would be healed if she could just touch Jesus. If I could just touch him, he'll heal me. So her condition is described as, the Greek word is mastix, which apparently refers to like a whip or a lash or a scourge or a torment. So there's both a, you know, physical suffering here, like being whipped or tormented, but there's also going to be shame associated with this because she's unclean, as we're going to see. And we don't really get it, but apparently in the Greek, you've got these participles. Mark dramatizes her circumstances really well. You've got a series of participles. And so one of the Greek participles, one of the commentators translates it this way. Having a blood flow, having suffered from many doctors, having exhausted all her wealth, having not improved, but having gotten worse. And then there's also equal emphasis in the verse when he says she suffered much for many physicians and exhausted all of her resources and gained nothing. Her situation is just as desperate as Jairus' daughter's situation. And so it seems that she either has some kind of a chronic menstrual disorder or a uterine hemorrhage that's not only painful, but makes her ritually unclean, which means she's excluded from social and religious circles. She can't touch anybody. She can't participate in the religious life of the community. For 12 years, she's been on the outside. So normally a woman would be unclean if she had her monthly period for 7 days, but this woman would be continuously unclean for 12 years. But notice the woman's actions in verse 27. Hearing, came, and touched. Why would she choose to touch Jesus and not just ask him directly to heal her? Why is it touching? Well, Mark doesn't really give us any clues as to why she believed that touching his garments might heal her, nor does he make any judgment about her orthodoxy at this point. But notice the manner in which she approaches Jesus. Verse 27. She came up in the crowd behind him. Now, either because she's behind, you know, and she's this is the only way to reach him, or there's a note of caution and hesitation on her part. She knows she's unclean. She can't touch anybody. So she's maybe thinking, I'm going to secretly come up, just touch him. He'll heal me, you know. And so she's being humble and respecting the fact that she needs to occupy a very inferior position here, all in faith. So her condition excludes her from normal social relations. She's ostracized. People would look down on her for being so bold as to come up directly to Jesus, as Jairus did. And so she thinks that maybe she could just be healed and slip away unnoticed, it would seem. Right? If I just touch him, then I'll just slip away from the crowd. And with respect to her belief that touching Jesus would heal her, there are several possibilities that were discussed by the commentators I looked at. In ancient times, it wasn't uncommon for people to believe that the famous and glorious rulers possessed the power to heal them through their touch. And so Alexander the Great, crowds used to mob him just to touch him because they thought he was God. And of course, it was superstitious. And so one thought is, well, is there a superstitious element to this? Thinking, I touch him from a superstitious perspective. Another perspective is that maybe she saw Jesus as a representative of God who, at the, you know, like at the altar or the tabernacle, could render those who render holy those who touched him. Alternately, and I think more likely, she knew how Jesus operated. She knew how Jesus was going around. Would you look with me at chapter 3 and verse 9? You see, Jesus was in and among the people, and he touched them. And maybe she even knew someone who healed him because she's from this town. In Mark chapter 3 and verse 9, it says, "And he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd, so that they could not crowd him, so that they would not crowd him. For he had healed many, with the result that all those who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him." This is Jesus' mode of operating. And maybe she knows somebody else who's been healed and realizes, he can heal me. So the theme of touching connects this event to Jairus' situation. And Mark leaves us with a beautiful picture of faith without editorial comment. She heard, she came, and she touched. And of course, Jesus is going to confirm that she came in belief. She came in belief and she acted on it. She sought to touch his garment. She believed and acted. And so she succeeded in touching Jesus, and the effect is immediate. Mark describes it in graphic terms in verse, going back to chapter 5 and verse 29. Immediately, the flow of her blood was dried up, and she felt, in other words, the verb here is she knew, from a Greek word meaning knowing experientially. She knew experientially in her body that she was healed of her affliction. And the commentator Edwards said, 12 years of shame and frustration are resolved in a momentary touch of Jesus. Touches him, gone, immediately. And the healing occurred without the intentional participation of Jesus. Jesus doesn't even know who he healed. And again, there's the humanity of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. Look at verse 30. Immediately, Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see the woman who had done this. But the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." So it's interesting that in the Gospels, the healings are never the end story. We never have it with, "And the person was healed and lived happily ever after," end of story. There's always a greater theological purpose here, because the goal isn't the healing of this woman. It's about who Jesus is and his power, his supreme authority. And so the greater theological purpose is, this is, we're called to respond to the revelation of God. This is the revelation of Jesus Christ. Do we believe it like this woman does? Do we believe that he's capable of healing anything, even of our worst circumstances, our sin, the sin that killed us. God is calling for a response. Again, these are not dusty facts from a historical narrative. This is calling for a heart response on our part. And our circumstances differ somewhat, but the conditions are always the same, and the same truth applies to us. Do we come to Jesus by faith in his ability to heal us? And we see Mark's love affair with the word immediately. It's all over the Gospel of Mark. We saw it in verse 29. Immediately the flow of her blood had dried up. And then in verse 30, immediately Jesus perceived in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth. There's also a parallel in the woman's experience and Jesus' experience. The woman felt, she knew experientially in her body that she was healed of the affliction. The same verb is used of Jesus. Jesus also knew within himself, experientially, that power proceeded from him and had gone forth. And so this woman's touch as an act of faith impacted both of them, giving a wonderful demonstration of Isaiah 53 and verse 4, surely our griefs he himself bore and our sorrows he carried. And Jesus healed this woman, and he healed all those who would believe by faith, knowing full well what the future held for him. He did this knowing that yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. Do you see the compassion of Jesus here? He knows he's going to the cross, and he still heals sinners, rebels, those who reject God. And we also get another glimpse into the humanity of Jesus, who turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" He's not a magician, a soothsayer, a shaman, or a witch doctor. The healing of Jesus has no magical effect, as Grasmick says. Aware of how the miracle took place, Jesus turned around and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" He wanted to establish a personal relationship with the person untainted by quasi-magical notions. This is not magic. Jesus wants a personal relationship with the person whom he healed. And so, of course, Jesus' disciples are exasperated. They're only looking at the circumstances. Verse 31, and his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" I mean, they see this as just a mundane event. Of course, you're going around, you're healing everybody. And they're saying, essentially, why bother? Is it worth finding out who you healed? Who cares? Let's keep going on. We've got the crowds, would be the implication here. But of course, Jesus has a greater purpose in mind. And it's well put by the commentator Edwards, who says, "The persistence of Jesus in discovering who touched him rivals the woman's persistence in reaching Jesus." Jesus scans the crowd. He's got to know who he healed. She wants a cure, however, a something, whereas Jesus desires a personal encounter with someone. Jesus heals people. He doesn't heal crowds. He heals an individual, and he wants to know who that is. And so it also means that Jesus has the ability to distinguish who touched him from the massive crowds around him, and everybody's probably knocking into him and stuff, but he knows power has gone out from him. And so Jesus' question and searching the crowd, the verb here for searching the crowd is he's looking penetratingly. And we've seen it before in the Gospel of Mark. I just can't imagine the scene. Can you imagine when Jesus is standing there and he's just looking eye to eye? I mean, I don't know about you, but I'd probably be a puddle in the ground, right? It's like he's just scanning the crowd intently. And so we also see this this deep humility and gratitude that this woman came in fear and trembling. From the Greek verb phobimei, with awe and reverence, and fell down before him and told the whole truth. So we see this deep, the woman's deep humility and gratitude. And I mean, Jesus is just looking to see who it is. He doesn't call her to anything. But what does she do? She doesn't attempt to escape unnoticed. She doesn't dart through the crowd. She steps up and gives her testimony. And it's a testimony of the whole truth, exemplifying what we find in 1 Peter 3:15, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. A lot of times we cite this verse as a justification for apologetics. So I'm going to learn about apologetics, how to defend the Bible. That's not what Peter's saying here. What is your testimony? Who were you before you met Jesus, and who were you after you met Jesus? And here we have this humble, unnamed woman who steps up and gives the whole truth. That's her testimony. And she's, and Jesus didn't even ask her to do it. He just wants to know who he healed. And she steps up in boldness, this meek and humble woman who approached him from behind, hoping just to touch him and be healed and maybe slip away. She steps into the middle of the crowd and gives her whole testimony. And of course, Jesus validates her testimony as a declaration of faith, saving faith. He says in verse 34, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." Could Jesus say that to us? We need to ask ourselves that in the middle of the trial. When God has brought me through this trial, will Jesus be able to say, "My faith made me well"? Will he be able to commend us for our faith? And so look at the trials in your life and ask yourself, will Jesus commend me for my faith? Will I come to him in faith, believing that he can see me through this? That's the issue that is being put on display here. Here is the heart of the story. Faith that believes in Jesus. And Jesus' response to the woman is remarkable. Had this been any other Jewish man, they would have been unclean, right? It would have been an inconvenience if this woman touched any one of us in the crowd here, because she just made us defiled. She just defiled us. And we have to go through all the rituals and so forth to not, and wait the appropriate time to not be defiled. Not so Jesus. He's not defiled because he's God. He brings cleansing. And so Jesus' response makes this woman the central figure of the story, and her faith is a model for Jairus. That's the bigger picture here. Jesus is putting this woman on display as an example to Jairus and say, "Will you believe?" He's putting her on display for you and me. Will you believe? Will I believe that Jesus is the supreme authority? He can handle my situation. He can handle my trial. And so let's note that this woman is singled out in the crowd to provide a unique testimony about Jesus' power to heal her. Will we do the same? Can we do the same? Can we display the same level of faith as this woman? This woman had been a sort of living dead person for 12 years, ostracized. She could have nothing to do with the community. Here she's healed on the basis of her faith in Jesus, anticipating the dramatic raising of Jairus' daughter, who died after living for 12 years. So now we go back to the second part of the story. And we know the main point here, and we're going to look and see how does it play out in Jairus' life. So the story's going to turn back to the first character, Jairus, who must be concerned. Think about Jairus' situation. Okay, we got this delay. My daughter's dying. What must be going through Jairus' mind? Verse 35, while he was still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, "Your daughter's died. Why trouble the teacher anymore?" But Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, "Do not be afraid any longer. Only believe." So this delay has created a severe test of faith. I mean, he was desperate when he came to Jesus. He knew she was dying. Now there's a report that she did die, precisely what he wanted to avoid. And from the perspective of somebody who doesn't believe in Jesus, Jairus wasted his time. It was a total waste of time to go to Jesus, because Jesus is preoccupied by the situation over here. She's dead. There's nothing that the teacher can do for you anymore. That's the response of the crowds, because they don't believe Jesus has the power to raise her to new life. And so the unidentified informants say, "It's not worth troubling the teacher. There's nothing you can do. All hope is lost. Give up, Jairus. You've wasted your time." And of course, that's what the world does. Eventually, the world gives up its empty exhortation. They say, "Believe." But really, we know that the agents in which we believe, if they're anything short of God, Jesus Christ, are powerless to change us. And what happens? We become cynical, right? That's the inevitable result, is cynicism, if you shoot for anything less than Jesus Christ. And our text says that Jesus overheard what was said, which really fails to communicate the nuance of the verb that's used here. The verb translated overhearing carries some different meanings. It means to take no heed of, or to hear carelessly, or to pretend not to hear, or even disobey, which seems more appropriate to the circumstances. It means that Jesus discounts what they have to say. In other words, he heard what they had to say, but he didn't accept the implications. He refuses to believe them because he knows what he's going to do. And that he doesn't need, that Jairus doesn't need to be troubled, that Jesus is in control of the situation. And so, knowing what they said, but not accepting the implication, Jesus turns to Jairus and says, "Do not be afraid any longer, only believe." And so Jesus is effectively challenging Jairus. Will you look beyond these hopeless circumstances to believe that I have the power to overcome your daughter's death? The worst thing that could ever happen to you. Do you believe? Will you believe is what Jesus is saying. And so Jesus has taken Jairus to the brink of human despair and dangled him over the edge of the cliff. It's like he's holding him over a cliff. Okay, you're going to believe. You're going to believe in me, in a sense. And so the commentator Edwards describes it this way. The present tense of the Greek imperative means to keep believing, to hold on to faith rather than to give in to despair. With respect to his daughter's circumstances, Jairus' future is closed, but with respect to Jesus, it's still open. Faith is not something Jairus has, but something that has Jairus, carrying him from despair to hope. Jesus' authoritative word to Jairus is not to fear, but to believe. Will Jairus believe that death is not a barrier to Jesus' power to respond to Jairus' plight? Will we believe that even death is not a barrier to our being reconciled to God? And of course, we all have many of us have a favorite verse, you know, Romans 8:28. We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purposes. And after a trial, we love to cite that. It's like, oh, look how good God was. But the question is, can you cling to that verse in the middle of the trial? God will see me through this. Jesus Christ will see me through this. And so, God is testing our faith to grow us in faith. That's why he gives us trials, to test us in our faith and to grow us. Their trials are by design and under God's sovereign control, and we have to affirm that, like this woman, this unnamed woman, affirmed it, believing through the trials. So, again, what's going on in the heart and mind of Jairus as they proceed to the house? Look at verse 37. It says, "And he allowed no one to accompany him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing. And entering in, he said to them, 'Why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep.' They began laughing at him, but putting them all out, he took along the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was. Taking the child by the hand, he said to her, 'Talitha cum,' which translated means, 'Little girl, I say to you, get up.' Immediately the girl got up and began to walk, for she was 12 years old, and immediately they were completely astounded, and he gave them strict orders that no one should know about this. And he said that something should be given her to eat." And so, including Jairus, only three disciples, Peter, James, and John, are allowed to accompany him into the house. And these three disciples serve as the legal witnesses to Jesus' power to raise her to life, just like they'll be the legal witnesses at his transfiguration when we come to chapter 9. And also in the Garden of Gethsemane. And this is a faith-building experience for them because they're going to have to believe when Jesus is hung on a cross. You have to believe that he has the power to overcome his own death in order to save them. And so these disciples form the inner circle, and Jairus is at the center of this challenge. And so Jesus is working as much in his disciples' life as he's working in Jairus' life. And of course, the rest of the crowd melts away, and the professional mourners serve no other purpose than to heighten the drama. Come on, Jairus. I mean, now Jairus is under intense social pressure because of what they said to, really? Really? They're laughing. They're scoffing. So it's just gotten harder for Jairus. I mean, Jairus would look like a fool if he believes Jesus and Jesus is incapable of raising his daughter. Really, Jairus? So there's even now intense social pressure on Jairus to not believe. Will he still believe? And then imagine you're not just standing over your sick child to pray for her to return to health, but you're standing over your dead child to pray for her to be raised to life before us. Will he believe? Will you believe? And notably, Jesus provoked this reaction. He said, why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep. Jesus provokes them, right? And so here's a further challenge to Jairus. And of course, the professional mourners, they surely could detect if she was truly sleeping or if she was in a coma, they could detect her breath. They were professionals at this. But this is a sleep. She's coming back. It's a sleep death in a sense. Now, there's nothing in the Bible that supports the idea that that death is a sleep state, but she's going to be awakened to life only to then die again. But so it's as if experientially she's asleep and she's going to be awakened from a death sleep. And so the Edwards says, the professional mourners represent the hardcore realists of every age who decide when empirical realities have foreclosed on divine possibilities. And so just like with the previous informants, Jesus takes no heed and of their disbelief in Acts. Verse 41, taking the child by the hand, he said to her, Talitha cum, which means little girl, I say to you, get up. And so Jesus issues a command, not a magical incantation. And yet there's also a tenderness to Jesus's word. The word Talitha is a word of endearment. It means lamb. It also means lamb. So he's saying, little lamb, get up. And so cum is an imperative, arise. And by touching her, he shows that death has no power over Jesus to defile him. He controls death. And imagine the scenario. Kent Hughes puts it really well. He says, can you hear the word as it falls on the girl's cold, dull ears? Can you see her eyes flutter and open wide? The first thing she saw was the face of Jesus, and then the face of her mother and father, and then the three enraptured apostles. I mean, can you imagine the situation? Two words, and Jesus brings this girl to life, and the effect is immediate and dramatic. Immediately, there's that word that Mark loves. Immediately, the girl got up and began to talk. And immediately, they were astounded. And so Jesus once again gives a puzzling command to silence. He gave them strict orders that no one should know about this. Why? Because he doesn't want people to come for the wrong reasons to him. It's not the physical illness or death that are the main point here. It's his power to save people from their sins. And of course, he also shows his tender care by pointing out she needs something to eat. She needs to be sustained. So what do we learn about this? In conclusion, if we focus on outward circumstances, consider the difference between the characters. We've got Jairus, who has status and privileged position. We've got the hemorrhaging woman, who's a social outcast with a shameful condition. Jairus has a name in the community, and this poor woman remains unidentified. We don't even know what her name is, and we won't know until we meet her in glory, right? He boldly approaches Jesus face to face. She comes meekly from behind. But who holds the advantage that'll make a difference in 100 years? It's this no-name, hemorrhaging, defiled woman. And the physical healing and the raising from temporary death are just the outward effects. That's not the main point. The main point is the inward spiritual condition. Let's contrast there. Who has the advantage there? Jesus says to the hemorrhaging woman, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction. Whereas to Jairus, he says, do not be afraid any longer, only believe. Why is Jairus afraid? Because he's trusted something less than who Jesus really is. This woman of no social standing, defiled, believed in Jesus' power, and she's commended, and she's a model of faith. Jairus needs exhortation to greater faith. And so he, in a sense, is rebuked by Jesus. And yet, is that our biggest problem, that we need to be rebuked for our lack of faith? That's why this text for me was very challenging to study this week. I see this woman and her faith is put up there. But I feel like the father in Mark chapter 5 who says, Jesus, if you can heal my son. And Jesus says, if you can. And he says, I believe, help my unbelief. What are the sources of unbelief? Is our greatest need for repentance right now to confess unbelief to Jesus? And here's God's grace. God exhorts Jairus to believe. Only believe, and he strengthens him through that. And that's why God has ordained your circumstances to strengthen your belief, if only you would believe. How about if we end with that thought?
Heavenly Father, we thank you for the power of Jesus Christ to cure everything. And we know that it's not the hemorrhaging that this woman experienced, or even the temporary physical death that this girl experienced, that are the main point. It's Jesus' power over everything, and that he came first and foremost to save lost sinners. May we believe, Lord, and even for those who are of us who are believers here today, how often do we fall into fear and trembling because we've set our sights on something lower than Jesus? We've tried to make you something less than you are. We need to believe. Help us to grasp that our circumstances every day until you take us to glory are ordained to strengthen our faith in Jesus Christ. Whether it's an unbelieving spouse, whether it's finance problems, whether it's problems with our children, our grandchildren, or other difficulties that we have, help us to believe. Help us to set our eyes on Jesus Christ and see it as a grace when you rebuke us for our lack of faith, knowing and trusting that you are strengthening our belief. And may through that, may we grow steadfast and have a powerful testimony like this woman who can step up and speak the whole truth, giving a whole account of who we were and who we are today in Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.